Let me first start by thanking you for the invitation, and I'm very happy that there's more people now talking about the need to make peace again. For almost 3 years, we noticed that peace and negotiations were seen as almost treacherous, something that meant surrendering to Putin, rewarding him for conquering territory, and possibly risking the liberal international order if we did not stand up to the Russians. And so, especially in Europe, we even punished leaders who called for restoring merely diplomacy. So things have gone quite extreme. We had the NATO Secretary General who took a page out of George Orwell's books, arguing now that weapons are the path to peace. So it's been a very absurd war in many ways. So I thought we can start by talking a bit about what I think this war is all about. And as the title of my book suggests, it's about world order. I think this is also something you hear said by American politicians, Europeans, as well as hinted by the Russians. And I guess what stands out with this war is how much facts and the narrative have now decoupled, because what is considered controversial, pro-Russian, or whatever words we use to censor now, this should all have been common sense, and it's easy to cite and provided evidence. But nonetheless, it's become a difficult thing to do simply because there's very little acceptance these days for any dissent. My argument that this is about world order goes back to the end of the Cold War, because this is really when we had an option what kind of world we should create. Do we want to return to a multipolar system based on the UN Charter? Or, for the first time, there was a real possibility of establishing an international system based on hegemonic peace. This is what we now refer to often as the liberal democratic order or liberal hegemony. So for Europe, this was quite significant because it dictates what kind of European security architecture we should have. Should we have an inclusive security system where we overcome bloc politics? Again, a lot of the motivations we had or hopes we had when we ended the Cold War. Or should we have one based on hegemony? Now, I often make the point that obviously the United States decided on an international system based on US hegemony, global dominance. Now, this, I would argue, could have many, well, benign intentions. That is, if there's only one major power in the world, what happens then? Well, there's going to be less competition among the great powers, so you mitigate the international anarchy. And also, because the US prioritizes liberal democratic values, it's assumed then that they would be able to elevate the role of liberal democracy in the world and overcome some of the crudeness of the power politics of the past. So I don't dismiss that there were good intentions, but when hegemony was chosen, it's also worth remembering that many people warned against this unipolar system simply because, well, what will happen over time? Well, running an empire is quite expensive. So over time, the US would begin to exhaust itself economically, socially, politically. It would begin to hollow out its core. Meanwhile, because unipolarity can only continue by keeping down other rising powers, it would incentivize other major powers to begin to cooperate and collectively balance the United States. And we also see this now with BRICS countries and other arrangements in which even countries friendly to the United States are, they still don't want to live in a unipolar world, so they want more balance. So even they are joining in. So the decision, I guess my key criticism of the whole narrative with the war is how it's taken out of context, that somehow this happened out of nowhere. And this is really incorrect because many people did predict this. When we decided to go for unipolar world order, what it meant for Europe is instead of having this inclusive European security architecture, we would merely expand NATO, that is, expand the bloc politics to have one side which dominates. And this is, of course, recognized as canceling the post-Cold War peace. This is not just coming from me. George Kennan, the main diplomatic figure from the United States, he recognizes Jack Matlock, who helped negotiate an end to the Cold War, recognizes also betrayal and would start conflict with Russia. Indeed, George Kennan even predicted in an interview with New York Times in 1998 that at some point in the future, the Russians would push back. And when this happened, the NATO expanders would say that, oh, this is just because the Russians are imperialist. Even William Perry was the US Defense Secretary under Clinton. He also even threatened, or considered at least, to quit his position in opposition to the decision to expand NATO. And this is the main thing. This was obvious. If we would return to bloc politics, try to create a Europe without Russia, even though Russia is the largest country in Europe, it would revive bloc politics, because now every neighbor of Russia has to be severed from them. And it's a bit like creating a North American alliance, but keeping the United States out, just filling Mexico and Canada with Chinese or Russian military bases. It's quite obvious how this was going to end. And I think for a while we attempted to reassure Russia while NATO expanded, but the real critical point came, I think, in 2008. This is when NATO offered future membership to Ukraine. We didn't give them a membership action plan simply because the Europeans resisted the Americans' push, because they knew this was going to lead to war. There's less focus on this now, but the Bush efforts to bring Ukraine into NATO was seen, not just in the United States, but especially in Europe, as something that would cause a lot of conflict. Keep in mind, Merkel argued, the Chancellor of Germany argued, that this would be considered a declaration of war by Russia. These days, we say Russia didn't consider it a threat. Of course, back in 2008, we recognized it was a declaration of war. The British ambassador to Russia even said in 2020 that if you want a war with Russia, trying to bring Ukraine in is the best way to do it. By the way, he also pointed out how it was based on a flawed principle. Keep in mind that, well, as the British ambassador to Russia said, again, the British, that this would likely spark a war with the Russians, but he also called it unnecessary, because between 1991 and 2014, barely 20% of Ukrainians actually wanted to join NATO. So again, this whole narrative we have that, oh, the Ukrainians really wanted to escape the shadow of Russia, join NATO, and the Russians wanted to keep them in their empire. But again, this is false, and this can be proven. Even William Burns, who was then the US ambassador to Russia, now I think he's still the CIA director, he even wrote a memo back in 2008, where it's called "Niet Means Niet," where he pointed out if we try to get Ukraine into NATO, it would likely trigger a civil war, by the way, which it did in 2014, and also Russian intervention or invasion, because they couldn't live with Ukraine being pulled into NATO, also, which happened. But he also made a point in his memo that this is something Russia didn't want to do, but they would feel compelled to do. Again, why? Well, I would compare it to Mexico. If the Russians or the Chinese tried to establish a military alliance with Mexico and place their missiles along the US border, I can't imagine any American presidency who would not react to this. Not that the Americans would want to, but again, like Burns said, with the Russians, is something they simply couldn't live with. Now, I think another false narrative here is based on this idea that this is it's been spun as simply being a Russian crusade for new territory. But this is not the case. It's very clear evidence that the Russians have simply been pushing hard for Ukraine to restore its neutrality, which is, by the way, in the Ukrainian constitution. Now, often when you criticize what NATO has done, it's assumed that, well, then you support the invasion. But again, this is also how the narratives are manipulated. I'm just saying that the main objective for Russia was always to prevent NATO to expand to Ukraine. And there's plenty of evidence for this. Keep in mind that in 2013, when the EU and the US attempted to destabilize Ukraine with this association agreement and supporting riots, the Ukrainians and the Russians came to the EU and they asked if they could have a trilateral agreement so Ukraine could be a bridge, not a front line. Again, the Russians didn't demand any exclusive influence. They just didn't want Ukraine to be forced to choose one camp or another to avoid the bloc politics. The EU said clearly, no, we will not accept trilateral agreement. Ukraine has to choose. As it happened, Ukraine decided to reject the EU agreement, and this is when we began to try to topple the government. Also in 2014, the Europeans negotiated this unity government with the government in Ukraine, because we had supported opposition, and Yanukovych, he saw this as a way of resolving the issue, to accept the unity government. However, within the next 24 hours, the government was toppled with Yanukovych. But instead of standing up for this government as guarantors, we saw that the Europeans instead as well as the Americans, recognized the government who took power in a coup, unconstitutionally, by the way, sent their top diplomats to make it legitimate. And as we also learned from Victoria Nuland and Jeffrey Piat, the Americans also had a very central role in toppling Yanukovych, that is the president. Even they got caught on tape 2 weeks before the coup and even planning who should be in the new government. With everyone they discussed, everything happened to play out exactly as they discussed on the tape. But nonetheless, we also have to refer to this as a democratic revolution. Now, after this, of course, we had, as Burns had predicted, a civil war broke out, also where Russia backed the Donbass rebels. This is when we got the Minsk Agreement. That is, the Germans and the French, they were able to negotiate a deal between the Ukrainians and the Russians to resolve this conflict. The Americans and British very much did not care for it. I remember John McCain called it Moscow bullshit. So the Americans and British then began to sabotage it as well, pump more weapons in. And as we later learned from both Merkel and Hollande from Germany and France, is they never intended for the Minsk peace agreement to be implemented. That is from between 2015 and 22. Instead, as both Merkel and Hollande said, the objective was to arm Ukraine, build up a huge, powerful Ukrainian army so they could ignore the peace agreement, so not implemented. And this is, by the way, something that President Poroshenko and then Zelensky, both the presidents of Ukraine, had after the coup, has recognized that the objective was never to implement the peace agreement. Now, this is problematic again, because we say that the Russian invasion was unprovoked, but for years, we all said the same thing. We said the only path to peaceful resolution in Ukraine is the Minsk agreement. And meanwhile, we were sabotaging it. We were not implementing it. And this is when the Russians asked throughout 2021 for security guarantees. If NATO was going to pull Ukraine into its orbit, surely Russia should have some security guarantees. Again, much as if the Russians would establish themselves in Mexico, no security guarantees were given. And as Biden said, he doesn't recognize any red lines. And this is when the decision was made. In February of 2022, the Russians invaded. Again, the narrative was that the Russians wanted to conquer all of Ukraine. Of course, this was nonsense. The amount of troops they had, where they were directed, all of this proved one thing very clearly, which was the objective was to pose a peace on Ukraine, that they had to accept neutrality. And as we suggest that the objective was to conquer all of Ukraine, we leave out very important facts, which doesn't conform with the narrative. For example, on the first day of the Russian invasion, Zelensky confirms that the Russians contacted him because they wanted to start negotiations based on neutrality. On the third day, they agreed already to meet, to start negotiations. Again, Ukraine would get its territory back, but they would have to accept neutrality. That was the basic outline of the deal. Again, we leave this out simply because it suggests that this was not just the Russia seeking territory, but it had legitimate security concerns. Also, what we leave out is while the Ukrainians were saying, yes, these are acceptable terms, on the first days of the Russian invasion from Washington, we had a spokesperson for Ned Price for the US government who was making a point that they did not accept starting negotiations. They wanted capitulation first. Russia had to withdraw, then we'll start talking to them. So, and also pointing out that this war is bigger than Russia and Ukraine. This is about again, he didn't use the world order, but that's what he effectively described. But the Ukrainians and the Russians, nonetheless, they came close to a deal. The main, again, terms of the deal was Russia pulls its troops out while Ukraine restores its neutrality. This was not acceptable, as we learned from especially the US, Britain, but also other NATO countries. This came from Zelensky himself when he, in March of 2022, he had an interview with The Economist. He even pointed out that many Western countries didn't want a peace. They prefer a long war because in a long war, they can bleed and exhaust the Russians. And he pointed out, even if this comes at the expense of the destruction of Ukraine and the death of its citizens. So at this point, Zelensky was still a bit critical of pursuing a long war, but nonetheless, pressure mounted and he effectively went with the deal. The NATO would send all the weapons he would require if he would just fight to the last man. Again, Lindsey Graham later on pointed out this deal as well, saying we're on a good path. As long as we keep sending weapons, the Ukrainians will fight to the last man. Even during the Istanbul peace negotiations in early 22, We had two main mediators, which were the Israelis and the Turks. Both the Israelis and the Turkish were saying exactly the same thing, that the Russians and Ukrainians both made the painful compromises. At the end of the day, it was Russia pulls out and Ukraine restores its neutrality. Both sides saw this as a fair compromise, but and they were close to deal. However, both the Israeli and the Turks said that for the Americans and the British, this was not acceptable because they saw an opportunity now to effectively start to kill Russians, that is fighting Russians with Ukrainians. So they wanted to bleed the Russians. Even Neil Ferguson, he wrote in Bloomberg, he did interviews with Americans and British officials in March of 2022, and he also wrote the same thing, that the only acceptable outcome now for the British and Americans was regime change in Russia and the defeat of Russia on the battleground. So no diplomatic pathway. We had the general or retired general of Germany, Harald Kujat, he was also the former chairman of NATO's military committee, pointing the same thing out, that the Russians and Ukrainians were close to deal based on restoring neutrality in return for Russia pulling out its troops. But this was sabotaged by the British and Americans, who again wanted to fight a proxy war. And this, again, is a long line of American diplomats, political figures, military figures who keep saying the same thing as well over the past 3 years. So this is a good war. We get to fight and weaken the Russians, not even losing our own troops. Meanwhile, we now can knock out the Russians and begin to focus on China instead. Even NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg used this logic when he argued that we shouldn't make any compromises or peace agreements with the Russians. He argued that if we defeat the Russians, arm the Ukrainians, then we're going to have a powerful, battle-hardened Ukrainian army capable of balancing a defeated Russia. This way, we can instead focus our resources on defeating the Chinese. Again, this is all very much linked to restoring the hegemonic unipolar world order, in which there's one center of power which dominates. This is why, for a while, it was considered Russian propaganda to suggest this is a proxy war and this was about restoring Western hegemony. However, Boris Johnson, who was, again, the prime minister in Britain when they sabotaged the Istanbul Agreement, he recently even pointed out, yes, this is a proxy war. And yes, our main objective here is to fight to prevent Western collective hegemony from declining. So again, yeah, this narrative we have embraced, it requires to ignore all these very, very important facts. And again, this is not something new. I know often it's treated as some kind of conspiracy theory, but we just finished the war in Afghanistan. And what was the lesson after fighting for 20 years? What did the media say every week, every day on the news? So we're winning, we're winning. Even though, as we later learned, this was not the case. The reality, the truth, was hidden. Now, why would we hide this truth? I think it's quite clear. If people know we're losing, there will be less support for the war. So to keep the war going, you have to pretend as if we're winning. And also we have to put a humanitarian spin on it, that this is a good war. That's also what we learned in Afghanistan. If we remember WikiLeaks, they leaked this report by the CIA in which they were pointing out the problem that the Europeans were losing interest in the war. So the solution was, let's sell it as being for women's rights, that this is something the Europeans cared about. So suddenly you have NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg writing articles with Angelina Jolie, arguing that NATO is the main guarantor for women's rights in Afghanistan. Suddenly, our 20 years of fighting in Afghanistan was about having schools for girls. And again, if you don't support NATO's occupation of Afghanistan, then you didn't care about women's rights. You didn't care about their schooling. Again, as if this is the main objective. So we did the same in Ukraine. Every day you turn on the news, Ukraine was winning, even though it definitely was not. So we kept making this point that Ukraine was winning, Ukraine was winning. And we often refer to this 2022 offensive from the Ukrainians when they took back Kherson and large parts of Kharkov. But again, this is also a false narrative. If we look at actually what happens, as I mentioned, when the Russians sent their troops into Ukraine in 2022, the main objective was to impose a peace settlement, restoring their neutrality. When NATO decided that they would instead convince Ukraine to fight, and they rejected any negotiations, not just negotiations, but diplomacy. They cut ties with Russia. And now they said, we're just going to fight until the end. Now suddenly it became a war of attrition. And this changed everything. So what did the Russians do? Well, they tightened up the front lines because they had overstretched their forces. They had thin supply lines, all of these problems, because they entered Ukraine with about 100,000 troops. This is not enough to occupy or win a war. So they needed an entirely new military and a new strategy. So they tightened up their front lines, which is also why they pulled out of Kherson and Kharkov, and they hardened their front lines, properly defensive lines, because in a war of attrition, the goal is to exhaust the adversary. You can take care of territorial issues later. And this is how we should have measured the progress in the war. And I know, at least in this country, our media keeps saying that, oh, the Russians are losing many, many more men than the Ukrainians. Again, it's a lot of fake news. We know that about 80 to 85% of the casualties have been from artillery. And we also know that the Russians have about 8 to 10 times more artillery than the Ukrainians. We know that they're dominating in terms of the drones, the missiles. But nonetheless, we keep pretending as if the Ukrainians have been winning. But how we should have measured it is how much the attrition rate has shifted. And the Ukrainians keep losing more men per Russian more and more every day. I think now for every Russian who is injured or killed is about 10 Ukrainians. But again, we turn this on the head in the media because we have to sell the idea that we're winning this war so people will continue to support it. And I think another problem with our narrative is it's always sold as unprovoked. Again, this is why we have to dismiss or ignore everything about the NATO expansion, about Minsk, Istanbul, because if you can sell this core foundation that this is, we accept that this was unprovoked, this is what's required for a long war, which Zelensky warned about effectively. Because if a war is provoked, then of course you can, that means we have also threatened Russian security. Then we can see Russia has reacted to this provocation and we can solve the conflict then by recognizing mutual security concern. We can come to an agreement, much like the Ukrainians and Russians almost did in Istanbul. But we didn't do this. Instead, we said it was unprovoked. And why? Because if a war is unprovoked, this means that the Russians simply entered because they wanted some territories. And then the best strategy is to increase the cost, impose a cost on the Russians for invading, and make sure they get as little benefit as possible. If it's unprovoked, we can say that, as Stoltenberg said, weapons are the path to peace. And if you suggest diplomacy, you're just rewarding unprovoked aggression. So suddenly, this lays the whole foundation for why a long war is good, why diplomacy is bad, and again, the Orwellian idea that war is peace. Well, I get a bit of feeling sometimes of a deja vu, because I remember when back in 2016, when Trump won the election. Well, what did Obama do in his final days? Well, he began to expel Russian diplomats. He shut down their consulate, putting a lot of sanctions on in the days before he left. And this was, of course, widely seen as sabotaging what was Trump's goal to, as he said, get along with the Russians. This was seen as being something negative and suspicious. But again, I think there's something similar we see now. That is, why do you have these great escalations, all these assassinations in Russia? Of course, you mentioned the decision to launch the TACMs against Russia. This is also quite dramatic, by the way. But as Blinken and the others said, for almost 3 years, they didn't approve the use of TACMs against Russian territory simply because this was seen as being too reckless of an escalation and it wouldn't have that much impact on the battlefield. But nonetheless, after Kamala Harris lost to Trump, suddenly now we see they reversed all of this and they decided to do it anyways. Now, it's quite a huge escalation. Keep in mind that this is very common of NATO as well, by the way, this incrementalism, this gradual escalation. In the beginning of the war, we were cautious about sending drones, tanks. At one point, Biden referred to sending F-16s as World War III. Now, of course, we are doing it. But these TACMS missiles is something very different. As the Russians point out, these missiles are operated by Americans. They're using American targeting, American intelligence. They're using guided by American satellites. This is effectively an American strike on Russia, on Russian territory. The fact that they've been used as well for the invasion of the Kursk region of Russia makes it even worse. So this is something very different. I often hear people say, well, don't the Ukrainians have the right to defend themselves? Yes, certainly, of course. They had their country invaded. They have every right in the world to defend themselves. But that's not the question here. This is about NATO becoming directly involved in the war. This is what the Russian president said as well. This has changed the entire dynamic of the war. Now NATO has effectively attacked Russia. It's a bit like saying the Iraqis had a right to resist America's invasion of Iraq. But of course, if the Russians or the Chinese had begun to bomb Washington, this would have made them direct participants. And this is what has happened now. We have gone effectively as NATO countries. We have attacked now Russia, which is the largest nuclear power in the world. And so again, this is quite dramatic. And the question for the Russians is, how do they react? Because they face a dilemma. If they respond, attack back against NATO, then they could trigger World War III. However, if they do nothing, then it will simply embolden NATO to escalate even further. Again, this is not even me. This is if you open almost any Western newspaper, what do they say? They say, well, the Russians would never dare to respond, to retaliate, because they fear NATO. So this is the dilemma. Do you retaliate or not? And I think the solution now for the Russians have been this new Oreshnik missile. It's very powerful. It can have immense destructive power. And even without the warhead, we saw the destruction it could cause. So this is seen as being the main weapon. Now, also, just as a bit of an irony, there is that the ATACMS haven't been able to, of course, reverse the tide of the war. But this is actually one of the reasons why the Russians have been restrained, because they see that the war is being won. So as long as they don't rock the boat too much, end up in a direct war with the United States, which would probably result in nuclear war, they're going to win this. So this is the main reason for the restraint. If we were actually successful in defeating Russia in a war that Russians consider an existential threat, a war for their survival, they would clearly resort to nuclear weapons. However, now that they have the Oreshnik missiles, they don't actually need nuclear weapons. But nonetheless, I think this is why it's quite a dramatic what has been happening now. And I know it's less than 2 weeks left of the Biden administration, but I think this effort to deliberately escalate tensions in order to make it more difficult for Trump to end the war, I think this is a key aspect. And again, it's often treated as this conspiracy theory, but this is what NATO is talking openly about. How can we continue funding Ukraine after Trump takes power? How can we effectively lock in the US to send more money even after Biden has left? So it's there is this, again, Zelensky pointed out, a long war. This is what we want to continue the fighting even as Ukraine is weakening. And we always use this slogan, like, we want to help the Ukrainians, help the Ukrainians. Well, at the moment, there's not a single oblast in all of Ukraine who wants to continue the war. Only 16% in the last opinion poll or so actually supports Zelensky. So what are we doing? Well, we're pressuring Ukraine to lower the conscription age down to 18 because we haven't bled out their youth yet. I mean, this is quite absurd, but we keep using these slogans over and over again. We're helping the Ukrainians. We're helping them. Yeah, just as a final note, keep in mind that in 2019, 73% of Ukrainians voted for Zelensky because he ran on a peace platform. He was going to implement the Minsk agreement. He was going to restore peace with the Russians. He was going to end the civil war with Donbass. And once he came in power, he was effectively threatened to reverse his entire position. So this is, again, another problem with the narrative. Well, if you look at the Democrats and Republicans, there are very little that differentiates the foreign policy. But the main one where it actually is a difference is Ukraine. So the fact that Trump wants to end the war is positive. I guess that they have two main concerns. One would be the ability to do so. Again, he wanted to have peace with the Russians when he won in 2016. But again, things only went from bad to worse. So it's the extent to which you can actually do this. But it's also, again, I applaud Trump for wanting to end the war, but on what conditions? So far we hear talks about simply doing a ceasefire. And in Europe, we're quite honest about what we want to do in a ceasefire. As President of the Czech Republic said, well, then he'll have more time to arm Ukraine. So again, another Minsk agreement where we just freeze the front lines, we can rearm Ukraine and fight the Russians another day. So they can't do this agreement. They can't have such a peaceful settlement. We refuse to talk about stopping NATO expansion. So there's no talk about restoring neutrality. Now, I guess the positive aspect of Trump is he doesn't have this strong commitment to NATO. So he could put on the table ending NATO expansion. I mean, this is the source of the war, and this would have to be a key part of a peace agreement. But again, after 3 years of war, there's been territorial changes, and to what extent would Trump be willing to accept these border changes or territories going to Russia? I think what the Russians demand now in a peace agreement, which is effectively Istanbul plus, that is restoring neutrality for Ukraine, plus the territorial concessions after 3 years of fighting, it's a very hard deal to swallow. And it's a huge defeat and humiliation for the Ukrainians. And as if it's not a good deal for Trump, who tends to pride himself of getting good deals, then what will he do? And I think usually the solution has been maximum pressure. But again, the Russians consider this a fight for their survival. This idea that you can simply bring in Ukraine into NATO in 20 years, that this would be a settlement, I think it's very flawed, because all you're saying now is we're going to have a war in 20 years. They want a permanent settlement. And if this can't be delivered, they're not going to take the deal. And then the question is, what will Trump do? Will he do maximum pressure, essentially continuing Biden policies? It remains to be seen. But I think some of his instincts, at least, are correct, which is the war is being lost already. At the moment, it's just death and destruction. Every day we wait, it's going to be more people dead, more territory lost. Meanwhile, we're pushing Russia closer and closer to China. So continuing this war now is just bad for everyone involved. So I'm hoping that this instinct will at least push for some diplomacy. I just can't see any peace agreement which the Ukrainians and the NATO countries would accept, which the Russians can't live without. I think this is my main concern, that I don't see that he necessarily can deliver what he wants to deliver. I don't contest that he's genuine about his desire to end this, of course. For many, they would consider this to have some of the dynamics of a civil war. For some, of course, this becomes offensive, because once you say that it's a civil war, suggests they're so similar that it justifies Russia's right to assert itself in Ukraine. But again, it's also quite interesting if you look at the names of high-ranking soldiers as well as regular soldiers. On the Ukrainian side, you have a lot of Russian names. On the Russian side, you have a lot of Ukrainian names. Again, and what we often neglect, because this is supposed to be, we're almost selling this as of a Russian genocide in Ukraine. But the country most Ukrainian refugees have fled to is Russia. So it's not really as black and white as people want it. But I agree, though, that, well, first of all, on the restraint issue, I think this full-scale invasion, war, it neglects some facts. For example, Newsweek, after 1 month of war in Ukraine, they pointed out that the Russians, on the first month of the war, actually dropped fewer bombs than the Americans did on the first day of the Iraq war. Because even Trump himself once said that the amount of bombing of Ukraine has not happened since World War II. But this is also not correct. Again, Iraq more on the first day than in Ukraine on the first month. This is not because the Russians are necessarily better people. It's just because they didn't want to cause too much destruction, because it would then prevent a possible peaceful settlement. And that, again, that was the key objective. Now, but I do agree, though, but I think that the relationship between Russia and Ukraine has become, Solzhenitsyn once referred to as a double-edged sword, because the countries have been so close for so long. They shared a state for centuries, and they both have the origin from Kievan Rus, which dissolved in the 13th century. Now, both considered, therefore, Kiev to be the birthplace of their, if not civilization, at least statehood. And for the Ukrainians, I guess this causes a split in the population, because if you're really this close, the Russians are your brotherly people. I know Ukrainians to the extent where they find the concept of Ukrainian state to be ridiculous, because they say, well, we're so close, we're the same people, why are we two countries? So this is also a problem. So for some, it suggests we should be even closer. But for others, the argument that they're so close is something that seemed to undermine their sovereignty. And this is quite legitimate as well. If you're in Ukraine and you see Russia refers to the common civilizational origin from Kievan Rus, then the natural condition would be for Ukraine, Russia, and Belarus to be one state effectively. So it becomes a challenge to state sovereignty. And I think this is why you had a division now in Ukraine. Like, I don't want to oversimplify, but for some, especially in eastern Ukraine, they consider Ukraine to have two languages, two cultures, two ethnicities. So effectively, they're a brotherly nation. And the worst thing you can do, and this is the nation building, the worst thing you can do is try to split these two nations apart. Now, in Western Ukraine, you often find a very different view, where they view this as, well, the centuries-long history of sharing a state with the Russians. They see this as an imperial legacy. So they would see we have one culture, one language, one ethnicity. So everything else is an imperial relic. So for them, nation building means to sever this tie with Russia. So you now have two identities which are in competition. and this where they consider each other to be the other, who's undermining essentially their statehood. So this is why it's very dangerous. Now, I think for a long time they were able to organize or mitigate this competition or this rivalry to effectively build some. My solution was always to have a distinctive Ukrainian nation, but not one which is anti-Russian. I think this is a good meeting point. The problem is also not that Ukraine is only a divided nation, but it's also on a divided continent. Because in Europe, when we revived bloc politics by expanding NATO, Ukraine either had to choose to belong to us or them, because they can't be aligned with both, because we abandoned the agreements we had for a pan-European security architecture. This is why in the West we find ourselves allied more with the people calling for one ethnicity, one language, one culture, which is why we also supported very much banning of the Russian language, purging the Orthodox Church, all of these things. And because we want a Europe without Russia, and the nationalists in Ukraine want a Ukraine which essentially tries to purge what they see as being the imperial Russian relic or inheritance which they still have in Ukraine. And of course, the Russians see it the other way. They naturally find themselves allying with the Ukrainians in the East, who consider them to be brotherly nations. So I think if Russia and NATO hadn't interfered too much in the domestic affairs of the Ukrainians, they could have solved this issue out themselves. But again, being a divided nation on a divided continent, as William Burns pointed out himself, this is why trying to bring them into NATO would effectively spark both a civil war and eventually a Russian invasion. But I do share the sentiment why this can be to some extent seen as a civil war, given how closely aligned the countries have been, and also how much families are married across. Again, I know families as well who have brothers who are not talking to each other anymore because they're on different side now of the border. So it's a very messy situation. Well, I think much like Afghanistan became a good source for financing the military-industrial complex, obviously Ukraine has been the same. So there's a lot of special interests in continuing this war, obviously. But also within Ukraine, there's a lot of natural resources. This is something that Lindsey Graham has pointed out over and over again, that Ukraine is sitting on trillions of dollars of natural resources, lithium, for example. This is not just coming from the Americans, even I forgot who it was, a German economic minister something along this line. He also made the point that if we're going to have the green transition in Europe, we really should have our hands on the lithium there, because this can't go to the Russians. Again, this is also what Lindsey Graham is saying. This in the Ukrainian natural resource should go to us, not the Russians. So this is why it's important to win this war as well. However, if you look at the economic resources in Ukraine, a lot of them are concentrated in the east. The dominant are actually in Donbas, which is the main concentration, if you will, of pro-Russians, which are the ones who initially rejected the new government that took power in 2014. So there is a struggle over this. And also this, I guess, is where the Russians have some advantage, because where you see most of the natural resources in Ukraine, it's in the eastern part, everything from Kharkov to Odessa. Now, this happens to be the historical Russian territories, which was previously Russian cities. And that means this is where most of the ethnic Russians live, the Russian speakers. So if they want to control this territory, these resources are, this overlaps exactly with where the historical Russian territories are. So this is why the natural resources are quite an important aspect of this. So again, when you turn on the TV, you get the impression that we're there fighting for democracy and freedom. I don't think that has anything to do with it. I think time and time again, we've showed, as I mentioned before, that from the toppling of the government 2014 until now, we're trying to reduce the conscription age. What the Ukrainians want, majority of Ukrainians, and what we claim to do to help them never seems to correspond at all. But it's also not just funding the military-industrial complex and getting our hands on Ukrainian energy resources. I think it's also the relationship between the Americans and the Europeans. Keep in mind now that both a French finance minister and the German former finance minister pointed out that, for example, the sanctions, they mentioned that this benefits America but harms Europe. The former German finance minister also recently pointed out that the destruction of Nord Stream, which he argues it was with the United States, also obviously benefits the U.S. because the Europeans, we had a kind of good deal, which meant we had access to cheap Russian energy, and we could export our manufactured goods to a huge Russian market. Now this is cut off. We now have to buy very much more expensive American LNG. And as a result, as this is the lifeblood of our industries are no longer competitive. Germany is deindustrializing very quickly, dragging down the other European economies with it. And as the Europeans are now becoming weaker and weaker, this is when the United States also launched this Inflation Reduction Act, where offering subsidies for German failing industries to move across to the United States. So there's a lot of, again, not just a German former finance minister, but more and more recognition that not being pillaged, but cannibalized. But I think that's a wider consequence of the war, because after the Cold War, a key objective in Europe, they wanted to pursue strategic autonomy, European independence. They used many words for this, essentially become more autonomous, independent from the United States. But this also requires you to diversify your economic ties, connect with all different major powers in the world. Now, we don't do this anymore because once the war began in Ukraine, the security dependence on the US increased. And of course, the US can convert the security dependence into geoeconomic and political loyalties. And this is what you see now. The Europeans agreed to cut themselves off Europe. Increasingly, they're agreeing to cut themselves off China. So the economies in Europe become much less competitive. So there's always incentives to continue conflicts. And again, I think this is also a weakness, if you will, of the hegemonic international system created after the Cold War. Because if you want a system based on hegemony, it requires an alliance system. In an alliance system, you always divide countries into an adversary, which could be weakened, and allies, which become dependent. And this is often, again, you see this between why this always seems a bit positive if you have conflict between India and China. This is why it's problematic if you have too much, if peace breaks out between the Arabs and the Iranians. And the same goes for Europe. You have more, as long as there are no tension with the Russians, the Europeans began to pursue more political and economic independence. The Russians started prospering. Now that we have war, again, the Russians can be weakened, and the Europeans, they become very obedient. So there's the systemic incentives under this unipolar system, I think, can be quite destructive. And you also see this in the economic sphere. Keep in mind, any discussion of even having negotiations or diplomacy has been seen as being treasonous, something you shouldn't do. Then you're Putinist and you're selling out the Ukrainians. Of course, it was always nonsense, the things we tried to do in the name of the Ukrainians. As I mentioned before, between 1991 and 2014, only 20% of Ukrainians want to join, but we still brought it, tried to bring them into NATO, even though they didn't want to, and we knew it would create wars. We ignored their elections when they voted for on the peace platforms. We were able to overturn this. And time and time again, even during the disastrous counteroffensive in 2023, you had the military leaders in Ukraine stating to Washington Post and other media that they didn't want to do this, that this would have too much of a cost on them, that this would be too destructive. But they felt pressured by Washington and NATO to nonetheless launch this offensive. So we keep saying we support Ukrainians, but rarely ever does it have majority support from the Ukrainians, and it always leads to disaster. So it's a very much of a bear hug. Now, the Europeans are quite interesting on this because if you look back in, as mentioned, 2008 and forward to 2014, it's always the Americans who pushed very hard, but for more confrontational posture towards the Russians, while the Europeans were holding back because they feared that this would provoke a war. But now it seems to change a bit. The Americans seems to be pulling back a little bit, especially now with Trump. But the Europeans have really gone all in, which is quite interesting because in the beginning of 2022, they were quite cautious. But I guess they believed they could defeat Russia on the battlefield. They can collapse their economy, isolate them around the world. None of these things happened. As we see, the Russians are winning on the battlefield. Their economy has actually been growing after they began to decouple from the West and align more with China. Even during the war, they became upgraded by the World Bank to the fourth largest economy now in the world. And of course, they're not isolated in the world. They just diversified away from the West and now pursuing this Eurasian partnership. But because the Europeans went all in, we haven't really accepted any dissent. All dissent is simply portrayed as then being a Putinist or taking the Russian side or betraying the Ukrainians. So you see, very strange and aggressive position being taken by countries such as Germany, for example, which has traditionally been very cautious. Again, Germany, I don't recognize it anymore. Now they're again backing genocide against the Palestinians. They're all for this war in Ukraine is quite astonishing, but it's bad for the security, it's bad for the economy. So I think the consequences are building up, which is why countries that don't pursue national interest or their own security interest or economic interest will eventually fall. And you see governments across Europe becoming less and less stable and popular. You see this in the United Kingdom. Germany had to call new elections now because the Scholz government has been horrendous. In France, after coming in third, Macron's party refuses to effectively share sufficiently power with others. This is also falling a bit apart. But again, we don't permit much dissent. We have two countries in Europe now resisting or pushing back, wanting to end the war, which is Slovakia and Hungary, and they're being punished for it. Viktor Orban of Hungary, you know, he even went to Kiev to meet Zelensky, went to Moscow to meet Putin, he went to Beijing to meet Xi Jinping. And the main idea was to try to map out possibilities for resolving this war. And the EU responded by punishing him because they said that, this was undermining the common effort and it was effectively making him a Putinist. When our media deals with it, they leave out the fact that he also went to Ukraine, that, you know, he's suggesting he just went to meet Putin and essentially doing his bidding. So everything is either support the war or you're a traitor. This is always what it's about. And always the idea is if you care about Ukraine, you'll continue this war. It's shocking because if we could have gone back to not just 2014, but even 2022, if we would have ended this war, Ukraine would have had its territory. Hundreds of thousands of men wouldn't be dead. But now, of course, the situation will only get worse and worse. But consequences are coming now to Europe. Austria as well now has to form a new government, where the new government appears to also want to end all weapons shipments to Ukraine and also restore relations with Russia. So, things are not going well in Europe at all. So I think this is going to be something that might provide some opportunity to pursue a peace. It's a good question. I think, we have the same problem here. I'm in Norway, and we also kind of identify ourselves, as popular to say, as a peace nation. But during the Cold War, being a peaceful nation meant you didn't send weapons into a war, to a conflict zone. You always called for diplomacy. Again, this is what the EU also always did. No matter where a conflict was, they would always, the first thing they would do, at least start talking, even though it might not reach a peace, at least start talking. But now, of course, everything was reversed in Ukraine. As soon as the Russians went in, the EU said, well, let's take out of the peace fund. They have money and they use this to send weapons. And they stopped all diplomacy with the Russians and essentially said that this would be resolved on the battlefield. So this is a new way of looking at peaceful nation. And I think this is something the way our country also changed after the Cold War, because the Cold War meant that you wouldn't provoke adversaries. Yes, you can deter them, but it has to be balanced with reassurance. Now a peaceful nation is one that bombs bad countries. So this is a part of the problem, I think, of the liberal international order after the Cold War. We divided the world into good versus evil, that is liberal democracies versus authoritarians. And peace then doesn't mean that you have recognition for mutual security concerns, that you seek compromise. Instead, you destroy the evil adversaries. This is how you have peace. Again, in 1948, you had Hans Morgenthau. He also pointed this out. The virtue of the diplomat is compromises. However, if you see the world as being divided by good and evil, compromise becomes an evil. And this is, I think, where we're now. So it's very hard. I don't feel my voice is heard in this country either, or anyone else opposing the war. We don't talk in facts anymore. We can outline the exact facts about how the Istanbul Agreement was, for example, sabotaged and all these things, but it's never countered with any other facts. Instead, I will hear accusations about my motivations, that I'm actually hoping that Russia will dominate its neighbors, that I don't care about Ukrainians. You know, you're a Putinist, they will use emotional slogans. Again, a lot of empty phrases, called pro-Russian, whatever that would mean. But you never get any facts anymore. And I think this is why discourse has become very difficult. So I don't really have a good solution to how to overcome this, because I do think a lot of the problems we're in now is exactly the inability to be heard and to actually have honest debates anymore. And I heard that with scholars in this country and abroad as well, that they all recognize, yes, you can't discuss the Ukraine war without talking about it in the context of NATO expansion. However, all the scholars also realize once you bring up NATO expansion as a source, then you will be crucified by the media because we're all about narratives these days. NATO has one narrative, the Russians have another narrative. If you start talking about NATO expansion or Russian security concerns, then you're repeating the Russian narrative and now you're taking their side and you're effectively a traitor. So it's very difficult to have any sensible discussion anymore, which means that we also can't identify the problems, we can't find solutions, and we can't chart a new path. I think if we could restore some debate and freedom of speech again, I think that would be a very important, necessary step in order to get an end to not just the war in Ukraine, but also the wars building up now in the Middle East. Again, we can go all the way back to the initial NATO expansion in the early 90s that many people saw this conflict coming. Again, I cited George Kennan before because he was the architect behind the containment policies against the Soviet Union. And he argued in 98 that the Russians will have to react at some point, and then we will call it unprovoked and just being evil Russians. But we can go more current times, which is right before the invasion. If you look at 2021, as I mentioned, this is when the Russians were. They had seen the incremental expansion of a presence of NATO within Ukraine, and they began to say, "This is, an existential threat. We need security guarantees." There was a lot of comments back then that, well, I think we should have recognized that the war was coming. For example, in November of 2021, the U.S. and Ukraine signed this charter on strategic partnership, calling for Ukraine's full integration into Euro-Atlantic institutions. They're going to increase the cooperation in the Black Sea to contain or to confront the Russians in the Black Sea. It effectively made Ukraine a de facto NATO member. Now, what is interesting then is that the Guaino, I think his name was, he was a top advisor for former French President Sarkozy. He argued that this charter convinced Russia that they have to now attack or be attacked. Again, this was his argument. And even in the United States, in December of 21, only less than 2 months before the Russians invaded, he also pointed out that as the United States continues to strengthen or entrench itself in Ukraine, in 2 to 3 years, Russia can't dislodge them. Then they're going to have to live in perpetuity with American missiles and weapon systems in Ukraine pointing in the heart of Russia. So he argued that the Kremlin being passive, that is not going to war, not doing something in Ukraine, is becoming more risky than actually doing a military intervention. So it's a bit strange, of course, now to ignore all of these warning signs. And indeed, we also heard from Zelensky's own advisor, Arestovich. He was even arguing that he was predicting back in 2019 that a war probably would start with Russia in 21 or 22, because this was a big war with Russia was the price to join NATO. And he said, well, the threat of NATO expansion will convince Russia it will have to intervene militarily. Once they intervene, he argued, NATO will come to Ukraine's support and will be able to defeat and destroy the Russians. Again, this is the advisor of Zelensky, and this is also pointed out. And he argued in 2021 that they're preparing for war with the Russians. So there was plenty of signs. Me, myself, actually, I wrote an article in November of 2021 where I argued the title was Wars Will Soon Be Unavoidable. And again, I just stated out the facts that this is where we're heading now. We're going to war if we don't find some security guarantees for the Russians. But if you predict it, you're not rewarded or said, oh, well, maybe you're right. No, I was accused of trying to legitimize an invasion because I said it was coming. So it's very extreme. You can only have legitimacy if you pretend nothing is provocative. But just as a final point, I would like to point out that in 2021, when Biden and Putin were discussing possible security guarantees, which Biden rejected, he got an advice, Biden, that is, from Kurt Volker. He's the former U.S. ambassador to NATO, and he was also a special representative to the Ukraine negotiations. And he actually wrote that the best possible solution is not to make a deal with Russia to have predictability. He argued the best success we can hope for is no deals at all. And he wrote, "Success is confrontation." That's a direct quote. "Success is confrontation." This is what he was advising for the negotiations with Russia, because any attempt to reduce Russia's concern would be appeasement. And this is also what happens if you think you're fighting evil. If everyone is a new Hitler, compromise is appeasement, and military victory is the only way to make peace. And I think this is why it should have been very predictable, I guess, that we were walking into a war. But it was impossible to say it now. Sorry, I know my answer is a bit long, but in terms of the economic interest, I think if you, again, I was in the beginning and mentioned I wrote a book on think tanks, and I think this is quite important as well, because if you look at not just the weapon industries, how they finance political class is one thing, but they're also, if you look at the think tanks as a main source of information and analysis in newspapers, but also providing briefings and information for Congress, the think tanks also hire a lot of people. If they're creating a lot of the information, and if you look at who financed them, majority is the weapons industry. Now this is a problem because you create incentives for looking for military solutions to all your problems.